Hello, I'm Matt Baum, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that's changed the lives of queer people. On tonight's episode, Auntie Mame, Mary Tyler Moore, and Doris Day. My guest this week is Ben Sander, creator of the character Brini Maxwell, a drag hostess who's helmed shows about crafting, cooking, and homemaking for decades. It all started with a little cable access show that he produced with some help from his mother, before becoming a cable TV series with live shows that continue to this day. And as Brini the character continues to evolve, Ben, her creator, is exploring new artistic frontiers. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that I've got a book coming out next year about queer sitcoms. It's called Hi Honey, I'm Homo, and pre-orders are now open. Head over to gaysitcoms.com to get all the details. Also, big thanks to everybody who supports The Sewers of Paris on Patreon. Patrons get hours of exclusive bonus videos about pop culture history, stickers and stuff in the mail, and names in the credits of YouTube videos. Now, here's my conversation with Ben. Well, this week I'm speaking with Ben Sander, the creator of Brini Maxwell. Thanks so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Great, me too. I've been a fan of yours for a long, long time. So I'm really excited to ask you, what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Well, it's kind of twofold. The film Auntie Mame was extremely important for me as a child. And the sitcom The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Mm-hmm. And anything with Doris Day in it.
Sure. Okay, great. I'm so happy to talk about these subjects. Let's start with Auntie Mame. How did you first discover that?
Well, you know, it was a broadcast on television at one point. I don't remember when or where. I just remember watching it and being completely transfixed by it. It's an incredible experience to sit there as a young gay boy and see this world created by this wacky woman who was equal parts glamour to her wackiness. Mm-hmm. And so it really defined me in a way, I think. The idea of her redecorating her apartment on a whim has always struck me as being such a... In fact, the original pilot for the Brini Maxwell show was done for Bravo, and it was based on that premise where Brini rents an apartment and then redecorates it every week.
Oh, that's great. And right. Can you describe for like folks who aren't familiar? I mean, we've talked about the various incarnations of Auntie Mame on the show before, but for folks who aren't familiar, what is it about and what were you seeing on screen?
Well, Auntie Mame is the brainchild of writer Patrick Dennis, and he wrote several novels about this character, this wonderful character who is the only living relative of a young boy whose father dies, and he goes to live with her. He was raised up to that point by a very conservative father, and Mame is a very liberal aunt. So there is a real culture shock for him as he goes to this new world. And she lives on Beekman Place in an incredible apartment with an amazing cathedral ceilinged living room, the kind of apartment that only exists in fake New York. Mm-hmm. And she takes him on all of these incredible adventures together. So that's Auntie Mame. And I always felt like Brini was one part Auntie Mame. She had that quality to her of big, glamorous, live, entertaining, having adventures and things like that.
And we should probably introduce who Brini is as well. How do you describe that individual?
Well, I have been described by Guy Trebe in the Village Voice when I was doing my cable access show here in New York as the prototypical pre-feminist 1960s homemaker. So that's kind of the foundation of what Brini was all about. She was one part Auntie Mame, one part Mary Tyler Moore, and one part my mother. In a typical episode, I would give you a recipe. I would do some sort of craft project or something like that. We might take some trip to some place to explore in New York City, and then we might have some sort of party or function or something like that. So that's what an episode was like, both for the cable access show, which I did independently here in New York, and for the series that I did for the Style Network back in the mid-aughts. The premise was similar.
You mentioned Mary Tyler Moore as an important influence, and it's so interesting to compare, you know, the Brini character as someone who is, as you said, pre-feminist homemaker, and Mary Tyler Moore, who I don't think I'd call post-feminist, but maybe I don't know, mid-70s feminism.
Right.
Tell me about Mary Tyler Moore. Like, was that, you know, how did you find that show?
Well, the Mary Tyler Moore show was, again, you know, I would sit down in front of the TV and in the afternoons, it was in reruns, and I would watch it. And I loved her independence and the glamour that she was able to get out of her life on a, you know, on a budget, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So while Guy Trepé may describe me as pre-feminist, and that was frequently what I was doing early on in the series, I have evolved, and I think the character has certainly evolved to include more of a feminist perspective on things.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, now I dress in period, mm-hmm, as authentically in period as I can when I play Breeny. And I started out sort of roughly defined by the period of 1954 to 1974. And that has since shifted. And I now embody looks that date up to 1987, 1989. Mm-hmm. So, it's an evolution of the character in my perspectives, as well as the character's appearance and sort of presence.
Were you, as a kid, consuming this stuff, interested in crafts and homemaking and hosting and decorating?
Oh yeah, very much so. I loved, my mother was an academic's wife. So she would entertain. She would have the students over after the shows my father directed, or she would have the faculty over for dinners and stuff like that. And it always seemed so glamorous to me. And I loved the glamour of that. And I always loved making things. I was very much about making things. I have a bachelor's degree in fashion design from FIT. So, my life has always been on some level about putting things together and making them pretty and mm-hmm, stuff like that. So yeah, it was a natural progression for me to have this television show, service television show.
At what point, and we may be jumping around a little bit here, but at what point did the Breeny character start to take shape for you?
Well, I moved into an apartment here in New York in 1995. And it was my first apartment. I moved out of my parents' house on Long Island. I wanted to decorate the apartment to look and feel like a 1960s movie set. Now, of course, this was a little tiny studio, postage stamp, fourth floor, walk up, cold water flat kind of apartment.
Mm-hmm.
But I really wanted it to feel like a 60s set. And I had some great pieces. I had my grandparents' 1950s Herman Miller daybed, and a Lane coffee table, and end tables that had belonged to my grandparents, and lamps. And so I had all of these wonderful pieces, and I had been collecting. You know, as a kid, most kids go and buy bubblegum cards or video games or stuff like that. I went and bought serving pieces. and vintage clothing. I had a vintage clothing collection. I had all of these things, and I brought them all together into this apartment and created this environment that was like stepping back into the past. Once everything, you know, was shut away behind cabinet doors and stuff, it was hard to tell that you were in the present day. And that, I just loved that. And I remember going to the Salvation Army and finding a set of mixing bowls in the Pyrex mixing bowls in the Butterprint pattern. And they're blue with little figures of farmers on either side of sheaves of wheat and corn. And they're charming, of course. And I brought them home. And then I realized that while they did add to the authenticity of the apartment, that when I was entertaining, no one would ever see them because they were for food preparation, not for display. Now, a lot of people display these things as part of their, you know, kitchen decor, but I'm a purist. If it's for food preparation, it should be in a cabinet and put away when your guests are there. So I decided, well, why don't I just do a television show? Then everyone can see my, you know, when I do cooking segments, everyone can see my mixing bowls. So that was sort of the impetus for doing the show.
And was that while you were going to FIT?
No, this was after. I had graduated in 93, and I had had a few jobs in the fashion industry and really did not like working in the industry. I went from moderate dresses to couture furs, and there are some horror stories of working for this couture furrier. And then was able to get my apartment from the job with the furrier, and then eventually moved to a moderate furrier downstairs in the same building. And that's sort of how I started, supporting myself over the course of the television show. And my parents, you know, when that job went away, thankfully, my parents supported me and helped me get the show off the ground. My mother produced it. And so that's kind of how that happened.
That's lovely that it was a family project.
Yes, it was. And I'm very grateful to them for their support in those early years.
Had you had experience performing, doing drag, you know, creating characters in the past?
Yes, I had. I mean, as a child, my parents, my father was a theatrical academic. My mother was an actress who worked all over the country in regional theater and stuff. And we were in Cleveland for a year at the Cleveland Playhouse, and they did a production of Watch on the Rhine. And my mother was playing a niece, the maid, and they cast me as Bodo, who's the child of the German refugees that are coming back. The daughter of which is the wife of which is the daughter of the wealthy Washington scion. So anyway, Watch on the Rhine. So I was on stage at the Cleveland Playhouse, which is a prestigious regional theater, and it was a delightful experience. It sort of set me apart from the kids at school, and I didn't win any friends under those circumstances, but it sort of gave me a taste for that life. The only difference is that I never felt like I wanted to sublimate my desire to play the parts that I wanted to play to the opinions and whims of the casting directors and directors that I might be working for. Mm-hmm. So I never really wanted to be a part of the industry in that way. I always wanted to do my own thing. And no one was going to hire me as Breenie Maxwell until I established a precedent for it. So that's one of the reasons why I sort of struck out on my own. And I had been doing drag for years. I'd been a member of the Imperial Court here in New York, and I'd done drag at the dances that the dance committee would hold at the Lesbian and Gay Community Services Center down on 13th Street. So this was sort of my first real foray into doing it professionally.
Do you remember the first time you saw drag being done?
Tootsie was a huge early influence. One of the things I loved about Tootsie was there was a reality to it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't outrageous drag in a way that felt like, that you immediately recognized was a man. There was a subtlety to it. And that's one of the things that I like about Breenie. I mean, when I was younger, I was, I was a skinny kid, and I had long blonde hair. And in my teens and early 20s, people would just mistake me for a woman all the time, a girl. In fact, I was at the community center manning a table with a lesbian who I'd never met, and she was coming on to me. A lesbian mistook me for a woman. Mm-hmm. So, it was a no-brainer for me to pass. Mm-hmm. And I loved the subterfuge of that. I loved being able to embody something in a way that was so readily accepted. And so that's one of the things I liked about Tootsie, was the supposition that we went into Tootsie. We had to suspend our disbelief. I mean, Dustin Hoffman does not seem or feel or look like a woman. But as Tootsie, they did such a good job of sort of building that facade, mm-hmm. there's just no reality. It's not really based in reality in terms of him being able to maintain that, 8 hours, 10, 12 hours a day on a soap opera set. But there was a sense of that being a reality in the confines of the story. And mm-hmm. that was really interesting to me. So I think that was an early influence. And there was something different from Mrs. Doubtfire, which was mm-hmm. later, but different from that is that the character of Dustin Hoffman played was still somewhat glamorous. She wasn't very pretty, but she was glamorous. She wore fashionable clothes of the era. And that's something that I've always, tried to do, is wear fashionable clothes of whatever era it was I was trying to embody.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go on a limb and guess that as a family with a lot of experience in theater, that you being gay was not a tremendous surprise or, point of difficulty with your parents?
Well, I mean, ultimately, no. My parents have been very accepting and very supportive. But it was rocky to begin with because my parents are, were older. I was born in 1969 and my mother was 36 at the time. So they were born in the 30s. Mm. And so they came out of a time where all the stereotypes were accepted as truths. Mm-hmm. And the idea of gay men and lesbians living lonely lives and being stereotypically effeminate and all of those stereotypes were what my parents had in their minds. And so they didn't want me to have to go through that pain of living a life like that. And they were not, while they certainly knew gay men and women working in the theater, they were not the people that my parents seemed to gravitate to. My father was not interested in musical theater. My father was interested in Brecht mm-hmm. and Shakespeare. And to some degree, my mother was the same. She would play these my father directed my mother in Mother Courage. So it's not exactly your typical gay, it's not what you think of when you think of gay theater.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some resistance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I imagine also that would have been around the 1980s or so, which I imagine, rightly was perceived as a difficult time to be gay.
True. Yes. And it was. And I did not, my coming out to my parents was not my choice. They found some literature mm-hmm. and confronted me about it about a week later. So we had a process. And then eventually I also had to come out as, someone who does drag to them. And that was mm-hmm. oddly painful in the late 80s and early 90s. So, it was a process. But they stepped up to the plate eventually and became, real supporters.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned your mother producing the show. Can you tell me how the... especially I think many younger listeners may not understand what cable or public access is. So how did that start coming together?
Well, cable or public access is a precursor to YouTube, essentially. It is an opportunity that the cable companies were forced to offer to the public for free and in New York anyway, for, you can pay for it and select time and choose how long you want and stuff like that. But it was an opportunity for members of the public to produce content of their own and distribute it through the cable system.
Mm-hmm. So was it something that you had previously considered? What came first, I guess, is what I'm asking, being a personality and an entertainer or having a showpiece for your amazing collection of things?
Well, I always felt like being an entertainer and a performer was sort of just baked into who I was. So I had really no problem with it. They say that the biggest fear that people have in the world is public speaking. That was never an issue for me. I was always easy. It was always easy for me to get up in front of people and talk. I mean, I do it once a week now for my event that I do down at Club Cumming here in New York. And I'm a teacher. So, you know, I stand up in front of classes three times a week. That was always just part of me. Doing the television show, I feel was a way for me to, what I loved about it was I was able to put something out there that I could craft and perfect. I love that about recorded media. You know, it's not something that induces stage fright.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, when something has to be memorized and done in a certain order, that is one of the things that can get to me. I'm not particularly good at remembering lyrics when I'm singing. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, that I'd like to be able to stand in front of a microphone with the lyric sheet in front of me. If I'm going to record something, that's so much easier for me. So doing the television show and being able to work extemporaneously felt very comfortable and easy for me. And being able to essentially write it in the editing room.
Yeah. What went into, especially in those early days, what went into the production of a show?
Well, you know, initially, none of us were very versed in production. I mean, the pilot episode I threw money at, I had gotten an inheritance from my grandfather, and I threw some money at this pilot by hiring someone to write it and then hiring some people to produce it or essentially direct it and shoot it. And we came up with a really, really great and funny pilot. And then I submitted it to this public access network here in New York, and they were really excited about it because they never get anything that's that well produced, you know, that has a real, you know, arc to the story and has, music under it and an opening theme song and all of the stuff. I wanted it to be kind of a combination of a service show and a sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a sidekick who was the neighbor character played by a very talented actor named Tom Hansen. So we had all of that going for us. And they slotted us in. This was in November that we submitted it and got accepted. And they slotted us in for January 1st air date. And so I realized that the following week, I had to have an entirely new show. And we had to have 13 original episodes or something like that. According to the way that we were working with them. And oh my God. So no, I think maybe we had to have 26 original episodes. It was some like incredible number of episodes that we had to do. So we had to just sort of get going and produce. It was kind of like, I describe it as being kind of like driving a Jeep over a rutted road at 90 miles per hour. So it was a very rocky process to produce these original shows. And they were kind of rocky to begin with. They didn't have the polish of the original pilot. But we fell into a rhythm, and we eventually started to get to a place where the production of the shows was more efficient. And my mother certainly helped with that. She provided some balance and some good ideas and some money. We got a new camera and equipment, and so we got it off the ground.
Did you, as you were kind of getting your sea legs with television production, to what extent did you look to the stuff that had inspired you as a kid, Mary Tyler Moore and Auntie Mame and all that?
Well, there's an entire episode of the original cable access show that has references to Auntie Mame in it. I get snockered on Caipirinhas. And this is before Caipirinhas had really taken off and, you know, people didn't know what they were. So we were doing a Caipirinha recipe, and as I kept drinking that, they're so sweet. And so the first time I drink it, I said to the guy who was making them, "And yet it's so sweet. Whatever do you use? Chocolate ice cream." And so that's, you know, and then we had that particular episode had multiple references to Auntie Mame in it. So,
well, that's delightful. I love that you're kind of bringing Rosalind Russell to a modern audience.
That's right.
Tell me about like the feedback that you got on the show.
Well, my mother used to tell this story about us leaving the edit suite where we would edit our episodes and walking up. It was way downtown in Wall Street, which is not a neighborhood that you associate with, you know, the gays and the lesbians. Mm-hmm. So we're walking up the street and there were these two people in front of us who were having a conversation saying, did you see this crazy show on cable access? It's this woman who keeps like living in the past and she's doing all of these wacky things and her neighbor comes over and we realized they were talking about us. So it was kind of exciting and heady to have people, you know, respond so well to it. It became sort of a cult favorite here in New York. Appointment TV, when that was still a thing.
Did you find that you felt like a different person when you were in character?
To some degree, yes. There's a sense of sort of freedom of being able to use all of your, you know, all of the sort of thoughts and feelings that you have about things and not feel like you need to edit or censor yourself because, oh, then that's too effeminate or that's too girly. You know, you can just sort of drop into all of that and become that character that, you know, you maybe have been punished for by people's reactions to in the past.
Was that something that you felt that, you know, at times being what they were, I imagine that you had to kind of self-censor at times?
Oh, sure. Yeah. In high school, definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it sounds like Breeny was, you know, an opportunity for you really indulge your interests.
Yes.
Well, I imagine that you probably heard from other people who were similarly enthusiastic for either the media that you were referencing or the Pyrex collection that you had and the entertaining that you were encouraging people to do.
Yeah, people used to record the show and send it to you know, on VHS tapes and send it across the country to friends of theirs to be able to watch it. And so, you know, we had a real dedicated New York following. And so it was very exciting when the show was recognized and by a production company who wanted to try and take it national. Mm.
Yeah. Well, when did that, when did that opportunity, do you remember where you were when that started?
It kind of came about after we had this big article in New York Times, which was really exciting. It's a very strange situation. Chris Hedges was the writer who was embedded in Bosnia Herzegovina during the conflict over there, and he wrote about all the atrocities that took place in this war and all of that. And then he came back to New York and was really looking for something to decompress from all of that. Mm. Tragedy. And so he started following around a male prostitute. He was going to write about the underground male, you know, sex industry. And somehow that led him to the world of drag. Mm-hmm. And he was at the Glammy Awards, which were and are still are an award that is presented for the best in drag variety, all the different varieties of, you know, ways of expressing yourself in drag. And I looked particularly good that night, and he was there, and he saw me, and he became obsessed, sort of fixated on me, and spent the entire evening just up in my grill asking me questions and wanting to know if he could come and do an interview with me the next day and all of that. And so I picked up a payphone, it's before cell phones. This was 98, I think. I picked up a payphone, called my mother. And, or it must've been 99, called my mother and said, can you get some tapes together for this guy? And then can we schedule a shoot? And so we did all of that and eventually became this 1600 word article on the front page of the Metro section. And, it was all about me. Mm-hmm. So that led to a lot of, attention. And one of the things that came from that was this, East Coast director of development for a West Coast production company who had also seen the show during her pregnancy. And she was fascinated by it and said she wanted to do something with it. And so we started working up potential, concepts for a show to do a pilot for. And we eventually pitched the pilot to Bravo, and they bought a pilot for us. So we spent the time putting that together. And I think I mentioned it earlier. And that was not picked up. They went with Queer Eye instead of us.
Mm.
And so we took that pilot and used it as the pitch for the Style Network, and they bought 26 episodes.
Well, that must have been a real change for the show. Like, I imagine that came with a lot more resources and pressure.
Yes, it did. We all of a sudden had to sort of put a team together, and my mother didn't have any television production, so she was not asked to direct, and it was painful for her. But we ended up with a showrunner who turned out to really understand what the character was about, and we were able to develop this show in a way that that I think stayed true to the original ideas of it. It of course changed. I was disappointed that they didn't want to bring the neighbor character on, and I think that ultimately was probably a mistake. I think the show would have been more interesting with her. But the show has developed a really nice following across the country. I still get responses about it, and we had a lot of fun doing it. I mean, we did two seasons for Style, and we got a lot of email response to the show. We got a lot of fan mail. And we shot in a genuine studio. We built a set. We went all over the country doing location segments. I think the show really stands up. I think mm-hmm. It has a real nice flavor to it.
Can you tell me about what Breeny has been up to in the time since then?
Well, I have shifted my focus. I've started to pursue a career in contemporary art. And so Breeny has been a part of that. The seeds of that you can see on my Instagram account. Instagram is a nice medium for me to work in. I really enjoy the opportunity to craft an image and then put it out there as a finished product. Like I was saying, I like to do with the content that I produce. So I'm developing some work based around the idea of the facades that we create in order to get by in society. And, it's been a part of my reality for so long, and how we can hide behind those facades for good or ill. It's not just about drag. It's also about the facades of seeming to be straight and how much more we are accepted when we present as straight. And so the work is visual and I think visually beautiful and compelling, but at the same time, it has this sort of undercurrent of wrongness about it, And I think that queer artists are in a particularly good position to explore ideas like that because of what we have had to go through in the past in order to have any kind of a success in our careers, any kind of a normal life. So that's kind of what I've been working on lately. And I'll be doing a show in Switzerland in 2023 of this work, along with a queer artist who's working as my mentor, Billy Boy. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
No, I'm not.
He's an interesting guy and has a lot of ties to popular culture as well.
Oh, that sounds great. So, and I think you mentioned that you're also at Club Cumming as well?
Yes, I do a weekly event at Club Cumming. It's called Make It with Breeny, and it is a crafting night on Tuesday nights from 6 to 8, and we explore all different kinds of crafts. And it started out as a knitting night. And then we, after the pandemic, expanded to all different crafts. And we do things like we have Shrinky Dink night, where I bring a toaster oven and we actually make Shrinky Dinks. We're going to be doing sugar scrubs and Santa pom-poms and things like that for Christmas. And so it's a fun event.
Are there ever times that, I don't know, that you find crafting and making stuff, has it ever gotten old, or is it always a joy to have something to make?
Oh, no, it's always a joy to have something to make. I just rented a small studio space here in my building that I have put all of my sewing supplies, fabrics. It is packed to the gills with all of my sewing stuff. And I go down there late at night, and I'm a night owl, and I'll work until 3 o'clock in the morning on sewing projects. And it is just so therapeutic for me to be able to do that.
So if folks want to find what you're making and working on and get details about the show and all that stuff, where should they go?
They should go to the my personal Instagram, which is Brini Maxwell, and they should go to the Instagram for the event, which is at Make It With Brini.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks to Ben for joining me, and thanks to you for listening, and thanks to everybody who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get backer rewards. Check out my upcoming book, Hi Honey, I'm Homo, for a history of queer characters on American sitcoms. Visit my YouTube channel for stories from behind the scenes of iconic pop culture, and you can keep up with even more of my work through my weekly newsletter. You can find all that and more at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kim McLeod and Camtech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time. Croissant.